Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
The Priest.
All I can think about is our descendants in a few hundred years laughing at us at what we thought was what. Can you believe they still spoke to each other? I mean, seriously, what a horrible way to communicate.
Actual words? Why aren't they just using telepathy? Oh my god.
Greetings, listeners, and welcome to episode 144. I am the Mean Team, and today I am joined by Dan Q.
Make sure you're sitting down.
The ever-caffeinated slash absent Makalua, and guest co-host LZ Purst.
Yep, that's me. Here.
A quote-unquote observation by Spark Yal. So this Civ idea and suggestion, the internet. Not sure what it would do, but something would be nice. Which, it'd be nice if the real internet did something too, but apparently not.
I don't know, lower productivity?
Pretty much.
Wait, it already does that, so what?
Yeah, why would you want to build a wonder that lowers your productivity? That's bad gameplay.
I see what you did there.
It lowers everyone else's productivity. I don't know.
Ooh.
Oh, but not yours.
Yeah, well, I would have.
What's going on, guys? Back here again, 2012 PAX East. We're at the 2K booth. Now it's time for some Civ.
There was an interview with Dennis Shirk, who is the producer, and he was answering not only some generic questions, such as, for those who are not familiar, what is in Gods and Kings? And also taking questions live during the chat. 2K Games, throughout this entire event, is using Twitch TV to live stream a number of events. Less than 24 hours after this was recorded, or maybe just a little bit more than, maybe at this point, some new information about Gods and Kings was, in fact, released. And the interview was about 25 minutes in length. It occurred about an hour into their broadcast yesterday, which was the 6th of April, a Friday. And I have some clips here that in total amount to about 8 minutes. I tried to get a top 10 things that they talked about in no particular order. Actually, that's a lie. It's chronological order that it was talked about. But I like lists, so I made it work for me.
Standing here with Greg. Greg's a community manager on the Civ title.
So specifically, we're going to be talking about Civilization V, Gods and Kings, the expansion pack that June 19th.
Or June 22 overseas.
Yeah, so June 19th in North America. So I have with me here Dennis Shirk, the lead producer of Civilization V, Gods and Kings.
So yes, you heard in there that the release date for Gods and Kings has been announced. Truly late spring, although I suppose if you're in Europe following what we consider to be spring and summer here in North America, it's actually early summer for you. It's June 19th for North America and internationally for June 22nd. And I liked a comment that was on a related forum on the 2K forums, which apparently Canada is not international anymore. Neither is Mexico. All the producers and developers seem to do that now. I enjoy that. There were a number of items that were discussed, and there was some new information that was released during the course of it. And one of the first topics that came up actually had to do with the introduction of religion. And by introduction of religion, of course, we mean to Civilization V, because we first saw religion in Civilization IV. And the question asked of Dennis is, what makes religion different this time around as compared to what we saw in Civ IV?
In Civilization IV, religion had a very big diplomatic impact. And when John went into designing the core diplomacy systems in Civilization V, what he wanted to avoid doing was putting yet another new layer on top of a brand new system that people already had to learn all over again. And it didn't feel like something that he really thought mixed well with all the rest of the new pieces of the game. Now, when Ed approached religion, Ed Beach, he's the new designer for this one, and what he wanted to do was approach religion in a completely new way, one that really fit. Yes, we have some diplomatic modifiers in there for that because we feel that's time. People have experienced the game for quite a while now. But a lot of the basis of religion has to do with beliefs and modifiers. This is a whole new way to tailor how you're going to play the game. So when you choose a pantheon belief, you're choosing a modifier with how you're going to play. When you're choosing a full belief, You might choose something that's going to help you out with your war game or with your science game or your culture game. It really is about tailoring a religion for you, not so much of picking a religion overall.
And we talked about religion when Gods and Kings was first announced, and a lot of the super sleuthing threads and what new information was coming out about Gods and Kings and what those different pantheon beliefs and the full-founded religion beliefs were going to be. And Dennis alludes to ones that you can choose that are going to help you. He sounded like he was putting in the context of going towards a particular victory condition, like a cultural victory condition or towards science. But, I mean, that just be a means to help you with whatever else that you are doing, whether it happens to be conquest or culture or diplomacy.
Isn't that a difficult thing to do? I think that's one of the reasons why they made the Civ 4 religion so, well, bland. They put no qualities to it in order to not be offensive in any kind of way. If they go the opposite direction here and say that, I don't know, Buddhism gives culture while Christianity gives production, I think some toes will feel stepped on, you know?
Well, Firaxis and, of course, Civ 5's developer and 2K Civ 5 publisher, rather than making it being an absolute bland, they've kind of put it in the control of the player. And in the sense that you're going to be able to choose, found a religion, you get to choose the name of the religion. There are some defaults, the more mainstream ones and some more obscure ones like Zoroastrianism. But you can also actually name the religion yourself. You can go in and you can actually say, no, I want to call it, you know,
Danianism?
Yeah, Danism, for example, which is totally awesome. It's overpowered.
Sounds like fun. Possibly.
Yeah, possibly. Really, I mean, religion and reintroduction of espionage, of course, espionage we saw for the first time in Civilization IV and then Beyond the Sword expansion pack, that espionage really wasn't talked about very much in this talk. It was just mentioned as far as how the influence of religion, by the time you get to the Renaissance, then espionage comes into play. And yes, religion is still there, but the impact is kind of quote-unquote downplayed, it seemed, relative to espionage. But felt it was worthwhile to include that quotation about religion, even though there really wasn't any new information, just because it's one of two big new mechanisms that, if you happen to get the Gods of Kings expansion pack for Civ 5, that when you play Civ 5, you are going to run across. You don't have to actively engage in it, but you are going to have to run across it. This question had to do with trait changes for existing civilizations. And by existing, we mean those that we have seen already and can actually play right now.
So someone is asking, are you going to be changing any of the unique attributes of the original leaders to incorporate faith and some of these new elements in Gods and Kings?
Not all of them. We did fix a few that didn't make as much sense. For instance, now we have defensive embarkation for everybody, and we can stack units at sea, because once a military unit enters the water, they become a civilian as long as they're embarked, so you can defend them with, you know, offensive naval units. But as a result, like, Askia's trait didn't matter so much anymore, so we've changed his trait, we've trained a few other traits to kind of integrate with some of these new systems.
Okay, so I got three things out of that. Now, one of them was that when you embark a unit, it now becomes a civilian on the water, but it can be escorted by a naval unit on the same X. That was number one. They noted that Askia's trait has changed, but they didn't. Dennis didn't say what that was, other than to say that it changed. And of course, the Songhai trait right now is that, in fact, units that are embarked can defend themselves, and right now they're the only ones that are able to do that. So, if you're going to make that available for all the civs, then indeed, hopefully, you would change that unique ability, because that kind of wouldn't be unique anymore. It'd be the opposite of unique. It'd be common.
Unless they got like triple defense or triple strength. That would be unique.
That's another way they could have gone. I think that this is the better way to go about it.
Yeah.
It's like, have any changed? Yes, we changed Songhai. No, they didn't press. See, if I was interviewing Dennis, I'd be like, and Dennis, that change would be. But Greg Labs, who's the Civilization Community Manager for 2K, is much nicer than I am, apparently. So, okay, that's fine. I'll live with that. Dennis, I got off easy there. But it just seemed, actually, that question talked about our existing civilization traits changing because of the faith, which, of course, we heard religion in the first clip, so there was the tie into that. And this has to do with existing downloadable content and the connection to the expansion pack.
Someone's asked if the earlier DLCs that we've released over the last couple years will be included. And I know the answer to that is no. The 9 civs that are in Gods and Kings are all brand new,
yes.
Not repeats of any of the DLC.
Right.
It is completely All brand new.
All brand new, except for Isabella, which we're throwing in there for the scenario stuff. She's an addition.
Gotcha.
So there's technically 10 if you don't own her yet as part of a previous DLC, that kind of thing.
I was mistaken. Okay, yeah. So it's 10 if you don't already have Isabella.
Yes.
So there you go. Now you too can find Skildorado, Eldorado, and enjoy increased happiness from natural wonders. Oh, boy. By discovering them. So, yeah, there you go. So, in effect, because there's Spain as part of one of the scenarios, sounds like then what he's saying is you get that as part of the base game, too. So, therefore, you get a DLC for, quote-unquote, free. Indeed, 5 or 6 up to this point of the new Civs had been named, as well as their leader, although not all of the traits had been disclosed of those 6. And indeed, one of those previously announced Civs, their trait is discussed a little later in this topic, but one of the new Civs is identified outright in regards to a city-state discussion, but we'll get to that. Before that in the talk, though, there was a question with regards to, has there been any changes to the artificial intelligence that we've seen from initial Civ 5 release, as well as what's come about through patches? And the answer to that is yes. And in fact, Dennis, again, the producer on Civ 5, speaks to 3 different aspects with regards to changes to the AI.
We've done a large amount of passes on the AI, from the Diplo AI to a lot of just polish everywhere else. We've obviously rewritten the naval AI. Once you see the AI initiate a naval invasion, you'll understand it completely because it's impressive and devastating and it's fast. An example for this for a naval AI invasion before, it used to initiate it and used to pick a target, and then it would take sometimes outwards of 50 to 60 turns to prep for it and then start its invasion. And now it's going to do it. It's going to prep for it. It's going to re-evaluate if it wants to do the same invasion. And that can be within, 10 turns. And it's very fast at doing it. We've made passes on the diplomatic AI. So now diplomatic options actually fade properly over time. So we've recoded that entire area so that if something's not that important, you're settling too near to us, that'll fade. It's not going to stick with you. We've gotten rid of the you're trying to win the same way of us because that just takes you out of the game. We didn't feel like it was a really good diplomatic modifier. So we've done a lot of work there in terms of having relationships change over the course of the game instead of it going one way and then staying that way for the rest of the game. And land combat as well, that AI work's going to be ongoing. Ed's been focusing a lot of his time recently, especially now that we're approaching the end of development, making sure that all the AI has received a really, really good pass.
The troll diplomatic modifier, as it is, seems to be removed.
You're trying to win the game the same way on turn 5. Well, that's good. Good to see that going out of the way there. It's no longer going to be an issue. It's one of those things where, you have to answer, I'll believe it when I see it, because it doesn't matter who's making the turn-based strategy game. I've yet to see really great AI in a turn-based strategy game. And I know to some extent it might not really be feasible to make one with the budget you have for a game, So when they say that they're going to make naval invasions more fast and devastating, keep in mind that they said this about Beyond the Sword as well, that they also made naval invasions much better from the AI and Beyond the Sword. And yeah, certainly, I joined the game a little bit late, so I wasn't party to this allegation of improved naval AI, but certainly in the final game, it's still not that amazing. So I'm sure they've improved it, and I'm sure, if you were struggling with it before, it'll just completely ruin you now. But I'm expecting that we're still probably going to be able to figure out the AI here. So I'm curious to see how much better they make it.
Yeah, it would certainly be an improvement from what it is currently. I mean, you can defend any coastal area with a couple of ships and just waiting for the AI to suicide the units into your warships. But with the change in both the defense for embarked units as well as an improvement in the AI, it might actually work. We can hope.
I think the big change there is when you allow an embarked unit on the same tile as an actual combat ship, I start getting the feeling that the AI is going to be hugging its combat ships a little bit more closely, a little ship-on-ship action there, the hugging, so that they're not so easily picked off. At least that's the impression I get by what you just said. And hopefully they do that, because then it'll be a lot harder to just lull kill things before they actually fight you.
Whenever there's a new system or there's a change to an existing system, how will the AI cope for the single-player experience or even the co-op multiplayer experience where you're dealing with AIs in whole or in part? And I guess speaking of AI, I love how these different parts kind of segue together and in chronological order too, which makes my life so much easier, has to do with city-states. A discussion about city-states resulted in the revealing of the identity of another civilization, one of the new civilizations that Gods and Kings is going to introduce, the leader for that civilization, and that civilization's unique ability.
Can you conquer city-states without penalty?
You can conquer city-states without penalty, and I've got to remember this right, because there's been a lot of different city-state work going on. One of the ways is with Austria, and that's one of the new civs that we're talking about here that probably people didn't know about. So,
well, there you go. So you got literally something new.
You would have known it on Sunday morning anyways, but Maria Theresa has a trait that allows her to basically diplomatically marry into a city-state and kind of absorb it into her territory, which is really cool. So there is that. There's also a way of defeating enemy city-states if you find yourself already at war with them, and that's as a result of a lot of the AI work that took place in regards to warmongering. Everybody was not a big fan of the way that warmongering was completely done in Civilization V. So you'd often get a lot of warmongering penalties for stuff that maybe wasn't your fault. And we've also done a whole pass on that system as well. So if you get attacked and you go ahead and take out that city-state as a result, you're not necessarily a warmonger. Additionally, we've changed up the way that city-states calculate warmongering. We no longer have it. One of the things we had was where all city-states would go to permanent war with you eventually. And honestly, that wasn't as interesting a choice then, because people just stopped invading city-states because it turned into kind of a pain to have to go to war with everybody. So now we have war weariness instead with them. At a certain point, they will band together, but it basically resets the influence level down to a default of a big negative. So you have to work twice as hard to try to get them into a positive or even to an ally in that situation.
Okay, the part about eventually if you're going after city-states and then you get all the city-states going after you, a lot of them going after you with the permanent war, you talked about it not really being that much of an interesting choice. It really kind of eliminated choice. And the further comment about, well, that just meant that people didn't go to war with city-states. No, it just meant that I knew that that was going to come about and I had to decide not so much I'm not going to go to war with city-states, but the timing of the city-states I go to war with and the city-states I choose to go to war with, knowing that the likelihood was there that there would be permanent war, be completely peace-blocked, it didn't matter what else you did in the game, that there was no chance for peace, I would take a number of things into account to decide what I was going to do then. So it wasn't completely no longer going after city-states. But now that we're not going to have that permanent war, that just opens up more choices to the player and reasonable choices to the player, and that can only be a good thing.
Yeah, sounds like a good change.
Yeah, sounds all right.
Then finally, with city-states on what the religious city-state type will be able to bring you, which apparently had not been disclosed before, as well as some clarification on mercantile CSs.
As you would expect, religious city-states actually give you layers of faith with friend and ally, kind of like culture city-states do. Other than that, he acts like a normal city-state, giving you all his luxuries if you're his ally, things like that. So if you're really playing a hardcore religious game where you really want to take advantage of everything that faith can do, city-states are your best bet. Well, the mercantile one is a favorite of mine. Mercantile actually gives you additional happiness once you become their ally, and they have a unique luxury, either porcelain or jewelry, that only they provide and only to their allies. So if you're allied with them, you're actually getting an added bonus of a luxury that nobody else has in the game, i.e. more happiness. So they're definitely a happiness-driven city-state.
I am going to start writing love letters to mercantile city-states right now.
Could be good.
Get access to happiness resources that you cannot get otherwise. And I mean, you have to be allied with them, but then nobody else can get those. Oh man, what happiness can do. I'm thinking about how that can play more nicely into my general warmonger strategy. Oh man.
I'll laugh so hard if they coded the AI to like viciously go for those. That would be amazing.
That's interesting you say that, because I remember when Civ 5 came out, the quote-unquote AI propers were really, really aggressive to the point of obnoxiousness with regards to competing for city-states. And now, a lot of the time, it's just meh. If they even do try to go back, like if I go and I take one of their city-state allies, they may try once to take it back. And then after that, it's just kind of, oh. And certainly if I go after a city-state myself, and they don't really seem to generally go after trying to take it away from me if I'm the first person there. So hopefully there's kind of a balance between what we had originally and what we have right now. Went from overwhelming to underwhelming.
Not concerned, but I'm wondering, if you conquer a mercantile city-state, do you get that resource, or does it just disappear? Because if it disappears, then kind of a strong incentive to not conquer them, unless, of course, the enemy has them. And wouldn't it be better to just give them one unique resource within their territory or something?
Well, that's an interesting question. Given that right now, with the militaristic, the cultural, and the not mercantile, that gives you the food. What's the
maritime?
Maritime. Thank you. I knew it started with too many M's. Too many M's. City state. bad. Now with the maritime, if you capture that city state, then if they happen to already be a friend or an ally with you, and yes, I've been guilty of this in a couple of situations. It's not even something that I purposely necessarily went for. It's kind of one of those situations where, okay, I'm going to take out, you know, this barbarian camp, or I'm going to, you know, denounce this person, or I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and it's, hey, look what you've done for the city-state. Now they're your friends or your allies, and you think, oh, I was just coming to get you. If you do that, then you lose that ability. So I expect the mechanic would be the same.
Yeah.
Mercantile city-state, or even the religious city-state, which apparently is giving you faith if your friends are allies with them, then you would lose that, and so that's a trade-off.
Yeah.
To me, that makes leaving mercantile city-states alone, in other words, keeping them as mercantile city-states, or if someone else went in there and captured them to go and try to liberate them so you could get that benefit. It's kind of how I view cultural city-states right now. Of all the city-states, I would say cultural ones are my favorite early game, early to mid-game, and then as you get to the mid to later game, that I'm more towards the maritime city-states. But now, mercantile just seems to be dreamy throughout the entire game. Yep.
Did you really just call something dreamy, by the way?
Yes, I did. I called the city-state.
Just checking.
Yes, I okay. did. You can quote me on that.
Dan dreams of city-states.
And then also in the talk at PAX East, just a couple of items left. One has to do with combat, but one of the new civilizations that Gods and King, the Civilization V expansion pack, if you're just tuning in, because I'm sure some people download the episode and just clicked like the start listening to the middle of the episode to get themselves completely lost, talking about the Huns, which have been previously announced, and Dennis wanted to respond to some of the observations that were made when people first saw a certain something in a certain screenshot.
Basically, the Huns still relatively work like any other civilization. So Attila's court is their capital. There's no actual capital. We wanted it to be kind of Attila's center. But they don't necessarily have city names. They're Huns, so they steal their city names from everybody else's lists. So as they expand outward, they might go from the bottom of other people's lists and start, you know, taking other people's city names. In terms of their trade is Scourge of God. And what that basically means is they're really hard workers. So they raise cities at twice the rate of anybody else. So they're really good at destroying cities. They start with horses. They get plus production from any of their pastures that they have. So your typical horse kind of base culture conquers. Now they're unique units. Horse archers are a unique unit. They also start with an early game battering ram, which actually replaces the spearmen. So you're going to be using them very differently than spearmen. The battering ram is absolutely devastating against early cities. So if you start off next to Attila, it's really dangerous. I'll leave it at that.
Translation, if you start next to Attila, you're boned.
Yeah, balance. Somebody. I mean,
it sounds like Attila would be fun to play.
You play Attila all the time.
Yeah, but now you have all these extra benefits, like raising the cities more quickly and having built-in kind of sort of siege immediately.
What's the point? Is it just to weaken the enemy? I mean, don't you want those cities?
You raise every city on the map.
Oh, yes, of course.
Back See, if the, there's no other cities...
You win.
Yeah, see, then you win. That's conquest. Yeah.
Built for conquest.
Well, definitely very map and situation dependent. I mean, there are some cities that you know that are just not going to be able to contribute very well to your overall strategy, whether it's
yes, of course,
gold or production, or, you know, this city will be useful, but it's going to take like 50 or 60 turns, and I might try to like to win the game before then.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to put the time and the effort into that and take the happiness, even though it's a puppet, but et cetera, et cetera. So.
Or once again, the AI has spammed up into the tundra where it's a crap city and well, it's just...
But those wouldn't take long to burn anyway. I mean, it's the big cities that you get an advantage from actually you getting that faster raise rate, yeah. Right? And those are the ones you're most likely to keep, I would think.
We could be going on a rampage.
I hate winters.
I'm burning them all.
I get the feeling that double raise is going to be taken advantage of more in a scenario of some kind. And then I don't know how much this is going to play into the base game. But yeah,
that's going to be monstrous in MP.
If they put it in the base game, then what you're going to see, it probably won't be a player Civ. If they put it in the base game, it'll probably be like one of those minor Civs from Civ 4 that no one even knows about. But they exist in some scenarios and can be put into any map, really, if you want them to be there. So it'll probably be something like that, where it's like the war, it's the enemy of everybody. And
basically, they're the organized barbarians.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's what the miners are, by the way. Organized barbarians. But, like you said immediately, I have balance concerns about this. Maybe it'll be off by default in multiplayer. Who knows?
We'll have to see also what early game means, because Dennis mentions it'd be devastating against cities in the early game. Well, he didn't mention specific eras. Is that just ancient? Is that ancient and classical? And also, it's going to depend on where the Huns start on the map relative to anybody else, including human players or other AI.
Yeah.
If they get stuck with the one Civ Island, well, not so threatening.
If you're playing on a continent's map and they happen to be on a continent that you're not on, perhaps they can become one of those runaway AIs.
Yeah, very likely.
God.
And I mean, a human player could completely abuse that. I mean, really go on a rampage, take all the capitals nearby, and then just destroy the rest and really run away with the game.
Yeah, I mean, like Magin said, you know, faster raising equals less turns with the happiness hit, which we kind of touched upon in part a little earlier. And Mackie, you mentioned MP. We had Osimo on last episode, Rob, and he was talking in part about, you know, in the games that he's playing, that there's the gentleman agreement that nobody builds the Great Wall. Well, the Huns are banned. I can already see it now.
That's going to be the first house rule. No Huns.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's a great idea, adding a Civ that automatically will get people to kick it out.
We're all Huns.
Or, it's like, so what color of the Huns are you?
Yeah.
You're the new Pika.
Yeah, I don't know. Another design choice, not fully thought through, I believe. I suspect.
They'll get added to France being banned in MP, as Magin also notes in the chat.
Yes.
And speaking how, not with also regards to the Huns, with the battering ram and the apparent siege, its strong ability from the outset, of course, this gets us tying into a lot of discussion about combat. And indeed, Dennis Shirk, again, the lead producer on Civ 5, had this to say about changes in the combat system that Gods and Kings will bring about.
All units have 100 hit points instead of 10 hit points.
Yes.
Can you go into maybe the design philosophy behind why that was the case?
Well, the original intention of the game was to have this ebb and flow to your lines. And what we found over the last just year and a half of like watching people play, seeing how people play the strategies, is that combat happened just a little too quickly for the original design intent. So you could say have two same strength units battling one same strength unit, and they're going to kill it. So you never had a chance for your lines to form. You never could really mount a stout defense. So we've rebalanced the combat values. We've rebalanced costs. We've made it so now it takes on average around 3.5 of the same strength unit hits to kill one of the same strength. So you actually have a chance to maybe survive a battle. If that catapult is left out in the open, you can pull them back, replace a unit. And it makes for a much cooler, more dynamic fight, which is really, really exciting.
What? No, it doesn't. It makes for more micromanagement.
It's going to make it take longer to take cities, which gives all the other AIs more chance to run away. We needed slower combat, guys.
I'm not sure about that. Basically, it's going to mean that it's going to be impossible to kill off units, so you're going to have to do the rotation game again and again and again and again. For every single battle, there's going to be the rotation game, because it's going to be practically impossible to kill off units unless you really have an advantageous position. I really don't like that at all, the way it sounds.
I was hoping that they were just going to make damage between like equally matched units, 100 hit points, but then you do 10 times more damage to each other. And then when you have situations like stealth bomber bombing something, or situations like the spear is attacking a rifle or something, well, okay, then. Now they're not going to guarantee to do at least one damage, or especially the case of, like, a logistics archer shooting a giant death robot a couple times. Now it's going to take 100 shots to kill the giant death robot instead of just 10. You know, maybe the death robot has a chance against some arrows, but this is not what I was hoping they meant when they were adding 100 hit points. This
beyond what's already been said and the concerns raised, and we talked about this, actually, a little in the past, because Dennis was quoted before as saying, as what they originally expected, that combat was going too quickly to survive. We kind of pounced on that. He kind of just reiterated that here and then gave us the more specific about, yeah, 3.5 units, same age unit, same type of unit, same strength unit, same era of unit. So now to me, the drive just is more about now through the technology tree. I mean, technology, and we've talked about the importance of pushing through the technology tree in Civilization 5 and compare it to Civilization 4. So to me, it's just more of an impetus to emphasize science so that when you move in, you're not going to need 3 units to go after 1 unit, because at least one, maybe at least one of those units is, if it's not a later era unit, then combined with the technology, having a bit more of your combined arms as well. So that, okay, if I want to take out this particular swordsman, yeah, I'm going to need 3-4 swordsmen to be able to do that. So maybe I want, you know, a long swordsman in there, or maybe I also want the ability to surround it with an archer and then a swordsman or two, and then you'll be able to take it out.
Yeah, well, still causes some issue, especially with the technology then. That means that if you're behind, you're
going to be so
much in trouble. And I mean, one of the most awesome single player games I ever had was when Japan, who was like a whole tech behind the Mayans, this was on another continent from me, just invaded them with like a heap load of more obsolete units, took thousands upon thousands, that's what it looked like, and just ran them over and made basically Pakal of the Mayans, totally Tokugawa's bitch. And I mean, you can't do that in Civ 5, can you? It's impossible practically, at least with these changes.
Yep, no more Zerg rushing.
Which is part of the game, at least. Unless you're the Huns. Then you can do the Zerg rush. So if you want to play that particular style, you have to choose that sim, which might be banned.
I'm cautiously optimistic that the push for the technology, and even if you set aside the technology, if you're at least in the same era, but you have that combined arms, so you've got the archery units combined with your melee units to go after a melee unit, I'm hoping that overall that combination will offset concerns that we have with regards to the needing through pushing the technology tree. So at least so long as you are at tech parity, then you have a chance, whether you find yourself going on the offensive or it's defensive or even an offensive defense. Like, oh no, I'm being invaded. Well, what do I do to destroy these units or at least injure them greatly before they get a chance to attack my cities? Or city, if you just have one.
And a few melee units to keep them away from your catapults. I don't know. We'll have to see how it plays out, but I'm skeptical. I'm generally skeptical, I have to say. I'm pessimist more than an optimist. I guess you can balance me out there.
It's going to be, may have to be tweaked the other direction.
There is more discussion, there's more interviews, there's more demos to be shown about Civilization V Gods and Kings, but they haven't happened yet, or they're happening right now as we're recording this episode, except that we were supposed to actually be talking about another related conversation to Civilization V Gods and Kings, but it didn't happen, and it didn't happen because of scheduling. Earlier in the day,
Elizabeth will be interviewing someone else for Civ as well, Lena Brink.
Yes.
And she is the associate producer on Civ 5.
Again, Elizabeth Toby, the head of community of 2K Games. But then after the interview with Dennis...
What's going on is we have demos for Civ running on a timer. And because you guys asked so many questions of Dennis and he ran a little long, Lena started in on a new demo. So she's in the middle of giving a demo right now. We will probably not have as many interviews for Civ 5 because Civ 5 has a theater and a demo. So a lot of our manpower is physically in the room.
So there you go. We talk too much.
We're too busy doing our awesome thing to talk to you.
More information of Gods and Kings coming about, and we'll be talking about whatever that information is almost certainly on the next episode 145 in a couple of weeks' time. And that is the news.
Well, moving on, we have a thread started by JPBar81, and it is titled Civ5Worlds.xml Analysis. And he was not joking when it comes to analysis. He even puts TLDR in his opening post in the first line. But basically what it is, it's a breakdown of the XML file that the game references. And he'll go line item by line item and explain his findings and what he thinks they should be. And, it's quite a long thing, so it's not something I could realistically read out on the show. But, for example, he has land hexes and, tells how what you enter there influences the number of land versus water, target number of cities, and he says it doesn't believe it has any effect. Hexes per city, hexes per civ, map size increased, number of cities increased, and so forth. So you get the picture. This is kind of like a blanket world generation thing, I guess. Although it doesn't have everything in it, just the actual number of land tiles, from what I can tell. It's not doing any bonus resources or anything like that. And they're discussing some changes, like maybe they want it to scale more standard or something, or maybe mess with the barbarian camps or whatever else. Do you think it should scale perfectly? I didn't see any problem with this in Civ 5 personally. I mean, I know it's not perfectly square, or it's not exactly the way it was in Civ 4, but that's not the kind of thing in Civ 4 that was king anyway, and so I'll see how it makes a big difference to change it a little bit.
When I first read this, my first reaction was almost the difference between when you hear people talking about equity and you hear people talking about equality. Right? Because there is a difference. Mm.
Yes.
Equality, treating everything equally, but then that, in fact, may not yield the result that you want, whereas equity is that in order to get to a comparable end result, you have to treat things, and this can also be applied to people, treat people differently, that you give them different tools, different opportunities, different approaches in order to be able to get to whatever we consider to be the wonderful world of, air quote, balanced, and being perfectly balanced, which to me is even more kind of, oh man, we are going to be here for a long time, and if we were here talking about trying to find a perfect balance, forget about too long didn't read, too long didn't listen. Oh, episode title. Polycast episode 144, too long didn't listen.
Well, it looks like from the numbers, they took the ratio of the huge map as what the proper ratio ought to be for their proposed thing, because everything has that same ratio. Everything's a little bit bigger, which I don't know. It comes into, I guess, a technical issue. And performance-wise, if you make even the smallest map that much bigger, how is it going to handle it?
But you have to do it for one unit per hex. If the maps are crowded, then you're not going to be able to do anything, because all your units are stacked on each other, and all you can do is flip your units from one tile to the other over and over.
Yeah, that's
there's
the
some
main,
kind of puzzle that involves that. I forget what it's called.
The whole design of the game is that playing on a small map, it's practically impossible to move your units. So you have to scale up the size of it. It doesn't handle well with the way the game's coded. So either they're going to have to rewrite some code in order to make it more efficient, or they're going to have to think of something clever.
On that, when you're getting with a smaller map, then not as much room to move your units, yes. And then I'm not necessarily agreeing with the following, but I can hear the other side, which is being, but at the same time, because it's a smaller map, because the number of cities that you can put on, there wouldn't be as much room for that city to expand and grow, let alone, having as many cities on there. So then that means that there aren't as many cities that are able to produce quantity X, which could include units. And therefore, at least the ideal being, you have proportionately less number of units. So therefore, it quote-unquote scales. We're getting into percentage considerations, perhaps also as compared to absolute values. And in JP Barr's spreadsheet here, yes, it's an image, but no doubt he put this into a spreadsheet. We see certain values being, talking about absolute, like the width and length for the world sizes for dual, tiny, small, standard, large, and huge. And then we've got hexes per city, hexes per civ, and he explains a lot of what he means here. But then it talks about, map size increase and number of cities increase in terms of percentage. Like hexes per city, the formula equals land hexes divided by the combination of civs multiplied by the target number of cities plus the number of city-states. So he is taking some liberties. He acknowledges this in some other parts of his formula in terms of what is the target number of cities, for example. And he's making some assumptions, and I'm not saying they're necessarily bad assumptions, but it's kind of, if you ask somebody else to do this same analysis, it's kind of like ask 10 different people to give an analysis on this information, and you're going to get 12 different opinions.
At least.
Yeah.
Of course, as soon as you go in and change one file for a modification, it's not in a vacuum. There's something else that you should.
Yep, cascading changes.
Exactly. So perhaps taking his proposed changes, it's one of those, it's interesting period. It looks like, I mean, I'm able to follow the logic. He's very well detailed, and it is making sense as he has outlined. But I think the next stage is to put it in practice to see whether some of those assumptions, like target number of cities formula for the hexes per city, actually yields the desired results.
There's one issue, and that is viable cities, because does it take good terrain into account? I mean, if there's a desert, or if there's, you know,
or if you get something that generates, like we've had in Civ 4 maps, where somebody gets stuck with a long horizontal continent that's all stuck up in the tundra.
Even
if you start on a peninsula, you can't. You can't, you know, like someone else will get all the cities, because they spawn such that they block you from the rest of the continent. Yeah. That happens a lot, too.
As far as land hexes goes, he does say, I figure including things like mountains, snow, and deserts in the calculations will roughly make up for the coastal ocean waters that a city could be utilizing when settling on the coast. So land is 30% of the total, and water is 70%. So there is, I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad assumption, but he's even saying that we'll roughly make up for that. And certainly depending upon the map type, and then also depending on just the random number generator, what it does to you, he's giving roughly make up. That's an average. And averages, I realize it's more difficult to even think about a median in this case, but a median is more meaningful than an average.
Hmm.
It's pretty rough. He's right when he says it's rough.
Well, good work. Again, being the critical voice here.
Recorded for episode 134 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, MSLS, and Locutus.
One of the most infuriating parts of Civilization 4 for me, because it's the only way you can play this part of the game well is to have the Buffy mod, and that is Bulbing. What specialist gives you what tech based on what prerequisites you've already researched? If you make the wrong decision early on, better options for Bulbing disappear real fast. And the most insulting of these is fishing. It's like a tech that you would tech at the very beginning of the game. And if you do it, it dictates everything about your Bulbing for the rest of the game.
Actually, no, it splits it off between two paths. But yeah, it really does close down a Bulb line entirely. So you don't have the third one anymore.
Yes.
So if I'm sitting there on a really nice capital site that has seafood resources and I decide to do fishing, I screwed myself, basically.
Well, there are definitely things
you can't do. Out of the engineering Bulbing.
You can't go down the engineering line. And if you wanted to go down the astronomy line, you have to be very careful as well. I personally have never bothered to memorize this properly because I'm so insulted by the concept. I feel it's an insult to me to learn this thing and play it properly.
But it's not that hard.
Well, you could just write it. If you really thought strongly enough about it, you could just type it out or write it out on a piece of paper and have it in front of you. And all you have to remember to do is look at the sheet. But I still haven't done that myself. So
there is a forum thread on SifFanatics called Great People Tech Preferences, started by Dave MCW, that shares for every single great person in the game. So you can just refer to that if you really want to know. Anyway, just to give a little bit of reference, this was a thread called Avoiding Fishing for Better Ping, and this started Z0WB13, so pronounce it as you will. But he's basically talking about or asking about some of the early gambits like Bulbing. And this is for great scientist Bulbing, because the Bulb paths for merchants, engineers, artists, and what have you are different, and you don't need block fishing to Bulb them. It's other things. But yeah, scientists, which are the best Bulbing candidates, because you get more beakers from a scientist Bulb than any other kind of great person.
Which is just silly, yeah.
Yeah, it's like 1,500 plus pop times 3 instead of 1,000 plus pop times 2. And so yeah, great scientist Bulb is significantly better. You basically have three paths for the great scientist. The most common one is Bulbing things like philosophy, education, paper, and liberalism. That's kind of your default path. As long as you've unlocked paper or unlocked philosophy, you're going to Bulb down that path. And that's the one that's, I would say, most commonly employed anyway. Yeah, And certainly you get more great people more quickly through the civic unlocked by philosophy, which is pacifism. And it's easily the best way to reach liberalism early in the game. You can get like 500 AD or even earlier liberalism. Okay, your next bold path require you go towards astronomy. And for that, you do want fishing, yes, because you kind of need it. But what you need to bulb astronomy is you really don't want to have civil service or theology researched, or you'll bulb paper instead of astronomy. And you have an option. You can bulb philosophy first and set up a better great person farm, or you can avoid meditation so that you can't bulb philosophy, and then you'll just bulb down optics and astronomy right away. And there's pros and cons to either of those. The final one, and the one that MLS adores so much, is the engineering path. If you don't have fishing and you do have things like math, aesthetics, alphabet, metal casting, and so forth, then you will bulb first machinery and then engineering. And you can get to things like trebuchets and crossbows at 500 BC, which is good enough to pull a rush with those units even at deity. But you can't obviously have fishing, and some civs start with fishing, so this particular path is closed down to a number of civilizations from the start of the game.
Most.
Yeah, there's fewer options to bulb, so it doesn't matter as much. But later in the game, you're looking for corporations or golden ages anyway, for the most part.
It's fishing, for God's sakes. I mean, the number of stuff you have where you need, you're going to need
fishing. You need fishing. Exactly.
Nuts.
That's the insulting part.
I don't disagree. I think Civ 5 does it better. It's kind of ridiculous in Civ 4 how you have to line up your tech things just so.
Not just that. Like, there's nothing in the UI that tells you.
Yes.
Nothing in the manual that tells you. The only
this
way
is
you can
something
do it
that people
is,
in the forums figured out
true.
And had to tell us about.
And I agree. You should pretty much have instructions on, you know, how to play the game from either the game or its instructions manual. You should not have mechanics of the game that are critical, crucial to gameplay being hidden to the player. That's completely asinine. Really closes down high-level play to a lot of players who just don't have the patience or the knowledge or the awareness of the Civ community to learn these things that they can't learn through the game without tremendous amounts of trial and error.
This is sort of the difference between where I play at, where I can beat deity, and where Phil plays at, where he's doing the actual competitive play online and posting his results, because Phil is insane enough to actually put the time and effort into doing this stuff right.
I just lift people's strategies on the forums for the most part. But yeah, I'm insane, sure. I mean, after all, I cast hours of gameplay as well. So yeah, I admit to being insane. But yeah, these bulbs are really, they are kind of frustrating in Civ 4. And I would have rather seen just specialists being stronger than having these superpower bulbs. Because the way it works now is the value of the great person is more than half of the value of running a specialist in the first place, especially early game before you have representation available and you don't build pyramids to run it.
In the chat, Bam Bam may have given us our closing statement for this topic. Give a man a fish and you feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish. Pretty soon he'll come at you with a massive flotilla of destroyers.
He will not have early trebuchets.
Yeah, he will not be able to go down the engineering line.
Nope.
Teach him how to fish, then attack him with your engineering line.
Wait, then how did you teach him to fish? Oh well.
Talking about something for the lazy and or frustrated people, and warning, me and team rant imminent. Imminent.
This thread is started by Failing, and it's titled Achievement Saves, but it should have been titled Cheating Saves, because that's basically what we have going on here. The purpose of this thread is to provide a hub to download like saves that unlock the achievements provided in Steam for you. All you have to do is download the game and run it, and load the save up, and boom, achievement get, as they say in Minecraft. I'm a little bit disappointed that Civ Fanatics has allowed this thread to exist. Yes, he put a lot of work into it, and yes, they told me that he put a lot of work into it. We'd feel bad kicking this off the forum, but this has no place on the forum. This will completely, like, Why even have achievements if you're going to cheat to get them? There's no point. What have you achieved if you do nothing and get the achievement? Absolutely nothing. You didn't earn it. Why have it? And some people say, oh, it doesn't matter. It's just an achievement on the paper. Well, in that case, then why are you cheating to get the achievements? Why cheapen the value for people who actually care about them? This whole concept is a bit disgusting. It's like people boosting in Call of Duty or people cheating with mod controllers and other shooters or anything else. There's no place for this on CFC. And this is one of the, like, this really hurts a little bit because I thought CFC was better than this. And certainly I would hope that most of the playing community is as well. Having a thread like this cheapens the value of the game to anybody who actually values achievements.
Achievements. You're doing it.
Well, I mean, that's one thing. But I mean, all right, if you value achievements, then you wouldn't go download them, I would hope. Right? I mean, then you'd actually strive to get them, like some kind of Pavlovian dog or whatever. But, I mean, really, do they even know what the word achievement means? Have they looked at the dictionary? Do these people speak English or any other language that has any actually semantic meaning? Really? I mean, come on! The point of an achievement is that you succeeded at something and you get a little piece of cookie for it or whatever, right?
Yes. And then, just download the save and pop this in. You don't get that little yes feeling when you actually get the achievement. Especially when you have to work for some of them.
Thread is fundamentally illogical. Because either A, you care about achievements and earning them, and therefore you go and earn them, or B, you don't care about achievements, but then why are you cheating to get achievements? This shouldn't exist. There's no reason this thread should exist.
Yeah, it's completely meaningless.
That's backwards.
It's made the word achievement meaningless as well. Congratulations, that's an achievement.
You have achievement unlocked. You have devalued achievement.
It devalues achievements for other people on Steam who actually attained them too, though. So it's almost doubly bad in that regard. It actually technically devalues the game as a whole slightly, because if you have any value, if there's any players out there who value gaining the achievements themselves and then seeing that show up on Steam, if there's even a few people out there who care about that, then a thread like this will cheapen the value of the game for them. And there's no reason for it. There's just no logical reason for this to exist.
It's the same as, you know, playing through the game with cheats. What are you going to get out of it, really?
Why don't you just give yourself 100 death robots on turn one?
Yeah, right? Or just eliminate all the enemy on turn one and then, hey, win. Huh? Oh, damn, I'm good.
Conquest, turn zero. Yes. Or turn one, I guess.
Right? That's not the point of the game. Rant and...
Spock says, highly illogical guy.
I don't have anyone to argue with here because everyone agrees with me. That's a little sad.
No. That's actually a good sign for once.
Yeah, it is. It is. It shows that at least there aren't too many people who are going to buy into this cheating crap.
I could play the other side just for a moment. No, you. There you go.
There you go. That's basically what it amounted to when I started posting in this thread.
Since we talked about Civilization V Gods and Kings, it's one of those April Fool's jokes that some people are kind of like, oh, I wish some of this was actually real, though. The Zulu are back. I, too, wish that was true.
Yeah,
come on now. You can't be Sith without Chaka.
Wonders, the Large Hadron Collider, and Walt Disney World.
Don't know about that. What would Walt Disney World do? Export culture?
Wait, did you say export culture or extort culture?
Same.
Both. Yeah, really.
The combat system, 2 units per tile?
Actually, 2 units per tile would be good. I like that, but yeah.
The improved automation.
Yeah, everything can be automated. You don't have to play the game anymore.
Extreme automation.
The additional uniques. It was also interesting. Of course, the giant death robot replacement for Japan named Mecha G. Oh, yeah.
So awesome.
That's what the giant death robot's real name is anyway.
No, the giant death robot's real name is Gundam. Mecha G is something else entirely.
Now, prehistoric start. It's like, what is this, Spore?
Oh, that's cold.
Did I say that out loud? Best part of that, though, even though I actually wouldn't like this myself, part of the reason why I mentioned what I mentioned, prior to discovering agriculture, you must explore and discover all the new technologies such as fire, tools, language, and don't eat that.
Can we have that for real?
I want that. That would be good.
I just want the tech of don't eat that.
Don't eat that is really expensive, too, by the way. It's hard to tech it.
I know there was a comment by a few people that said they liked most of everything that was in here except the cross promotion with the upcoming movie, except the cross promotion, except the cross promotion. But are you kidding? The best quote is in that block as far as I'm concerned. The joke was that 2K had struck a deal with Warner Brothers for Steven Spielberg to produce the movie Gods and Kings. Christoph Hartmann, president of 2K Games, is quoted as saying, "This will make strategy games way more contemporary than in the past," unquote. And I thought, you win. You win. I approve of this post for that sentence alone. That is excellent. For those who are not aware, Christoph Hartmann is the one who told us last year that strategy games were no longer contemporary. And that's why we were getting XCOM the way we were getting XCOM. Yeah.
Yeah.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
And now you can think about me singing, which in fact may even be a worse torture than my actual singing, because it may never stop.
No, it's already stopped. I mean, it stopped the minute you mention it, you know? It's like, yeah, dancing, whatever.
I still got you talking about it, though, see? Next best thing.
Becky still hasn't participated in the sing-off that would actually give her control over these matters.
I don't need to participate so you know, in the sing-off to listeners. Have control over these matters. I have seniority.
Well, you do. Not as much seniority as I do, unless you're talking about age.
Yeah, see?
Oh, we're going to go there, are we?
I didn't...
You said seniority, so I thought, okay, it's open season.
Oh man.
Staying himself a deeper hole. First the singing, now the age corrects.
All right, that was podcast number 144 with Dan Q.
It's April Fools.
What? Is it April Fools?
No. It's April Fools. See what I did there?
Yeah.
See what you did there, Dan. We're not impressed.
You're talking about it, so that's good enough for me.
And Mackie Makalua.
Who needs more caffeine?
Phil, the me and team.
Be sure to consult me for your weekly dose of don't eat that.
And me, John Ulzbrist. I have nothing further to add, Your Honor.
It's closed.
So, John, what are you in court for?
Sorry, what?
You said I have nothing further to say, Your Honor, so what are you in court for? What have you been charged with? Can I optimistically refer you, instead of as a pessimist, that perhaps you describe yourself as a realist?
Ah, well, isn't that a bit pessimistic? To say that my pessimistic criticism is more of a realism, but never mind.
Just shaking your chain.
Isn't that a pessimistic comment? I mean, you're trying to remain on Dan's parade here, after all.
I don't know, Mackie has seniority. I don't know about that.
You just can't leave it alone, can you?
I was referring to show seniority, actually. I don't know what you're talking about there, Mackie. Awfully sensitive.
Yeah. I don't think so.
Look, the Aztecs had it coming, all right?
It's Monty, come on.
Yeah. What do you think? Anyone?
I don't know who you're talking to. There's nobody named anyone on this panel.
Anyone? Anyone? Bueller?
Recorded April 7th, 2012.
Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.